This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Liam Fox. Coming up, protests against plans to build a massive mine along Papua New Guinea's longest river, and tiny Guam offers COVID-19 vaccines to lure tourists to the US territory. But first, Samoa is one step closer to having its first female prime minister after the head of state ordered parliament to convene on Monday after a dramatic and drawn-out election process. The Supreme Court also rejected an application to stay the execution of a ruling from earlier this week, which declared the appointment of an extra women's seat in parliament to be void. That means the FAST Party, led by Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, is set to form governments with 26 seats, while the incumbent HRPP has 25. She says her impending elevation to the prime ministership will be significant for Samoa and the region.
But, you know, for me, you know, as a politician, you know, it's where the journey has taken me thus far. I'm accustomed to the work, although the attention will probably be a much newer experience because, you know, I've essentially sort of stayed under the radar for most of the time.
In terms of the economy, getting it up and running, will you be seeking more loans and support from partners?
Perhaps not loans. I mean, when we get in, I think we need to look at what is actually there. The last supplementary budget we had last year with the last parliament, because of the COVID, there were a lot of you know, objectives that weren't met, mostly because of the conditions. So there was a lot of rearrangement of the budget. But I think to be realistic, the COVID has impacted our country as it has in other countries. So we're very wary about moving on to loans, and that would be a last resort for us. I think our general approach to the economy, especially as we start off, is to have a, you know, a sustainable approach to the economy. But, you know, talking about policies, Inga, one of the things that we really would like to give priority to is to increase the participation, you know, of the general population in growing the economy. So we're very much looking at working with the private sector, the general population, to, you know, put investments where, you know, people can begin to build and make their own livelihoods and make those kinds of contributions to the economy. Of course, you know, the government projects play a big part in stirring the economy. But, you know, some of those big projects we will definitely have to review, not only in terms of the impact that they may have, but of course the long-term sustainability if we take those projects on.
And one of those projects, and it was reported yesterday that you plan to shelve one of the major port projects that China's helped to set up with. Why is that?
Well, you know, Inga, we're a small country. You're referring, of course, to the Wharf project at Vayusu, right?
Yes.
You know, at the moment, our ports, our airport, you know, meets the needs of a small country. I think the you know, the proposal and the scale of the project is such that, you know, it's really not realistic. Let me put it that way. And anyway, it would not be a priority for us. So, you know, there does need to be work, you know, to improve our, you know, our ports and entry points. But I'm not quite sure, you know, that huge infrastructural projects are necessarily the way to go.
Samoa's likely next Prime Minister, Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, speaking to Inga Stunzner. In Papua New Guinea, the leaders of more than 40 clans who live in villages along the iconic Sepik River are sounding the alarm about a massive gold and copper mine planned for the region. It'd be the biggest in the country if built, and is being touted as a nation-building project that'll bring much-needed investment and infrastructure. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
The Sepik is the longest river on the island of New Guinea.
They say the Sepik River is a snake. It meanders, its tail is at the bottom. The snake coils and makes a heap with its body. So we are here for one purpose.
The representatives of more than 40 clans living along the river in PNG recently met to voice their opposition to a planned gold and copper mine project which would cover around 16,000 hectares. Marai Koni from Athatip village was among the speakers.
The constitution and the law gives us, the customary landowners, the clans and the clan leaders, the right to protect our resources.
The Frida River project, which is owned by the Australian-based Chinese-owned company Panost, includes a plan for an open-pit mine and hydroelectric project. The downstream communities are particularly concerned about a tailings dam and the risk of it breaking. 10 United Nations special rapporteurs also raised that in a letter to the company and to the governments of Australia, PNG and China, saying while it's deemed very unlikely by the proponents, a failure of the dam and the release of toxic waste would be catastrophic. The April gathering was organised by Project Sepik, a local NGO, which is being backed by groups from Australia. In audio of the event supplied by Project Sepik, Eddie Alka, a leader from Moom village, says local governments must protect the rights of residents.
The river serves a lot of lives. That's our lives and the lives of animals who survive on the river.
Alan Bird, the governor of the East Sepik province, where the proposed tailings dam would be built, has told the ABC he met with the clan representatives on the final day of the four-day gathering.
The Frida deposit is one of the largest undeveloped copper gold deposits in the world. So it's got global significance in terms of the resources it holds. But obviously, you can understand that the people who use the river daily for fishing and, you know, for their livelihoods and so on and so forth, and have done so for, you know, tens of thousands of years, rightly concerned about any adverse impact that may be coming.
Panost wouldn't comment for this story, but has previously said its mine proposal would provide long-term revenue to PNG, support local infrastructure development, and could double power generation capacity. The provincial government has also lodged concerns with PNG's Conservation and Environment Protection Authority, which is considering the proposal. The governor says the province will start legal action if the mine is approved in its current form.
PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reporting there. International partners have stopped short of increasing funding to Solomon Islands to help remove thousands of unexploded bombs left over from World War II. Two men have now died after an old and buried US projectile exploded earlier this month in Honiara. Rani Heyman has this report.
A family mourns the loss of another life and another victim of war more than 75 years after it ended. Four children are without a father, while their mother remains in hospital fighting for life.
It's very dangerous and very unsafe now. Right in our cities, right in our urban areas, right in our suburbs, everywhere there is bomb.
George Noda is the older brother of Charles, who died from the injuries he sustained when an old US projectile buried underground exploded earlier this month. George believes his brother's death and that of Razif Healy, who died very soon after the blast, could have been prevented.
We're just hoping that the government take into deep consideration in facilitating or negotiation with other NGOs or USA or Japan to carry out something to do with the bombs, because We don't want to see anything like this to happen again.
But the country is littered with unexploded ordnance. Just this week, police removed more than 100 UXOs from a suburb on the outskirts of the capital, Honiara, after being alerted by the local community. But the job of tracking down all remaining UXOs is a huge task. Australia, New Zealand and the US, in partnership with NGO Norwegian People's Aid, have worked to conduct surveys to help the Solomon Islands government create a database. But that project has been suspended indefinitely after two of its staff, including Australian man Trent Lee, died last year. The US ambassador to the Solomon Islands, Erin McKee, claims a local police investigation into their deaths is causing the holdup.
We supported the investigation into the accident, but we cannot move forward in our efforts. They've been stalled since that point in time until their report is completed. Following the report, the conclusion of the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force investigation, we will work with the government of Solomon Islands to determine how best to continue our support for UXO survey operations.
Ambassador McKee says she's hopeful the recent tragedy will push the process along. An investigation by the Norwegian People's Aid is already finished. It found Trent Lee and his colleague, Briton Stephen Atkinson, had been handling an 81mm mortar on a balcony at their office in Honiara, where they also lived, when it exploded. For the first time, the NPAs said that they discovered risk-taking behaviour by the men. It's told the ABC that, due to COVID-19 prevention measures, travel in and out of the country was not possible, and circumstances related to the pandemic efforts may have contributed to risk-taking behaviour, which seemed to accelerate until the tragic accident happened. A prolonged period of stay in one place, isolation, travel restrictions, and the absence of normal patterns of leave may have had a multiplier effect on the two. The MPA says when the local police investigation is complete, it will decide whether its work with the local Solomon Islands Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team continues or is shut down. Clifford Tanuki from the Solomon Islands Police Explosive Ordnance Team says a report is on the way.
I think it's going to its final end and the result will come out soon.
The US Ambassador to the Solomon Islands, Erin McKee, says the US is already playing its part.
Over the past decade, and then bringing it up recently, we've invested over $6 million US dollars specifically in the Solomon Islands.
She says they might provide more funding once they receive the police report. Meanwhile, Japan's ambassador to the Solomon Islands, Yasuhiro Morimoto, told the ABC that disposing of UXOs in countries like the Solomon Islands is a priority for Japan. He says the country is looking at how it can contribute, but how it plans to do so or whether it's done that yet was not specified. Australia too has been providing assistance in helping remove UXOs since 2013. The Defence Department says an embedded advisor works with the local police explosive ordnance disposal team and provided support in the response to this month's blast as well as last September's.
That report from Rani Hayman. We know COVID-19 has wrecked the Pacific's tourism industry, but Guam is looking to use the pandemic to its advantage with a vaccine and vacation campaign. The US Territory's Visitors Bureau wants American expats living in the Asia-Pacific region to fly to the island to get vaccinated and make a holiday out of it. But not everyone supports the idea, as Marion Farr reports.
Pristine beaches, fancy hotels, palm trees and cocktails by the pool, these are the classic ingredients of a holiday marketing campaign in the tropics. But on the island of Guam, an American territory in Micronesia, the tourism industry wants to add one more draw card into the mix, the promise of getting a COVID-19 vaccine.
We came up with the idea of the Airbnb as a concept to attract expats from around the area to come here and get vaccinated.
Carl Gutierrez, a former governor and head of the Guam Visitors Bureau, is spearheading the idea. He says there are about 750,000 American expatriates in the Asia-Pacific region alone, some of them in countries where access to COVID-19 vaccines is limited. Governor Gutierrez says it's a win-win, offering safety to Americans and an economic boost for Guam's struggling tourism sector.
I think we'll start getting our people back to work, you know, in the hotels and the restaurants, and get so used to it so that when the millions of people starting to come out, they'll already be so adept in handling the new normal and the new protocols.
Under current rules, only American citizens are able to fly into Guam and get vaccinated. On arrival, they're taken to a government-run hotel quarantine facility where they're given free accommodation to isolate for 6 days. On the last day, travellers must take a COVID-19 test, and when it comes back negative, they can go and get a vaccine, also for free. The Pfizer, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson jabs are currently on offer in Guam. Those who get Pfizer and Moderna have to spend about a month on the island, allowing time to get their second dose.
But in the meantime, you'll be a real tourist because you have already gone through the quarantine process. So some people, several have come here, one from Thailand, I know, and one from Philippines.
One of those is Ruben Shushman, an American businessman who lives in Thailand, which is dealing with a large outbreak of COVID-19. Mr. Shushman made the decision to fly to Guam to get a vaccine in early March.
In March, it was getting worse and worse in Thailand, and they were not, you know, executing in terms of having the vaccine. They're really slow.
Once out of hotel quarantine, he made the most of his time on the island.
I went out to a lot of restaurants, which I guess is somewhat touristy, but I did some diving. I did 2 dives last week. I went to the Blue Hole last week.
Mr. Shushman says the trip was definitely worthwhile.
With outbreaks throughout the neighborhood where I live and a lot of people ill, people have told me they're quite envious that I did what I did. So to me, it's worth it.
At this stage, only a handful of people have taken up the opportunity, but Governor Carl Gutierrez hopes many others will follow Ruben Shushman's lead.
It's got a potential to allow multinational corporations to send their people here, because they're not in line to get vaccinated from the foreign countries.
And he's convinced an influx of international travellers to Guam won't put the local community at risk. Last year, Guam had one of the region's worst COVID-19 outbreaks, but now has only 90 active cases, all in isolation. So far, about 75% of the population has been vaccinated, and health authorities are hoping the island will reach herd immunity in a matter of weeks. Hotel quarantine systems have been problematic in countries like Australia and Fiji, sparking new community clusters. But Nadine Leon Guerrero, the Guam Visitors Bureau's Director of Global Marketing, says the island's hotel quarantine has been successful.
There's very limited contact with the people in quarantine, and the food is actually dropped at their door, so there's no direct contact. And we're also using our National Guard to help us facilitate that process.
And she says the Bureau is looking at ways of also making vaccine tourism viable for non-US citizens by allowing doses to be sold privately to local medical centres. While some in the tourism sector would love to see business boosted, others feel conflicted about the idea of marketing the island as a vaccine destination.
At one point, I do see the need for us to be opening back up and the need for some economic energizing.
Monyeka Di Oro is an Indigenous Chamorro woman on Guam.
But in another respect, I think a global pandemic definitely isn't the place to capitalize on, or it's not the time. And if we really want to fight this pandemic, this global pandemic, we really should be sharing our resources instead of making money off of it, and sharing the vaccines with places that are being hard hit, like India.
She's concerned a focus on business isn't in everyone's best interest.
Capitalizing on a global disaster just isn't something that should be practiced anymore in this century where there's so much urgency and need for people to really be uniting and collaborating and remembering that we're all interconnected.
Guam resident Monyeka De Oro ending Marion Farr's report. And finally, the Olympic Games in Tokyo are just over 2 months away. But for the teams from Pacific Islands, there are still a number of unanswered questions. The global COVID-19 pandemic has complicated things significantly. And as Richard Hewitt reports, even for experienced campaigners, the Games will be a very different and difficult challenge.
There are three Olympic sports in which Pacific Island teams hope to make an impact in Japan: rugby sevens, beach volleyball and weightlifting. But the final list of competitors for all three events is still to be decided. And in the case of rugby sevens and beach volleyball, qualifying tournaments are still to be played. It's a situation that's making life hard when it comes to ensuring that every team member has been vaccinated against COVID-19. But the president of ONOC, the Oceania National Olympic Committee, Robin Mitchell, says there is a solid plan in place.
When the heads of government met virtually, where they had to select the new secretary general of the forum, the other agenda item was the vaccination project, and I was able to get in touch with the chairman of the forum, Kosi Anatano, who's the first president of the Tuvalu Olympic Committee, to get the governments to agree that all of the Olympic athletes and their entourage be vaccinated at the appropriate time after their border and quarantine staff and healthcare staff are vaccinated. And the meeting agreed with that proposal.
Athletes from the US Pacific Territories have been well looked after, and PNG chef de mission Tamsin Wardley says Australia have been very supportive to her team.
Most of our team has put their hand up to have the vaccination and have gone through the first stage of the AstraZeneca vaccine. We're very fortunate that the Australian Olympic team is working with all the countries across the Pacific so that those of us who've got athletes and officials actually down in Australia, they're joining in with the Australian Olympic team and getting the Pfizer vaccine down in Australia.
It will be no surprise if, regardless of their sporting ambitions, some Pacific athletes were reluctant to travel to Tokyo. But while a number of PNG's Olympic hopefuls have withdrawn, Tamsin Wardley says fear of COVID-19 wasn't the reason.
We've had a number of athletes pull out, not because of the risk of going to Tokyo, but just family life and work pressures has got in the way. The extra 12 months of having to train and possibly not working has impacted a number of athletes up here.
With several countries still unsure over the size of their Olympic teams, travel arrangements to and from Tokyo are proving tricky. Should either Tonga or Samoa in the final men's qualifier, and PNG or Samoa or possibly both in the final women's qualifier, grab places in the rugby sevens event, the likelihood is those teams will travel direct to Japan from Monaco, where the qualifiers are being played. Back in the Pacific, a Fiji Airways charter flight is on standby to carry a number of teams to Tokyo, but Robin Mitchell says getting back will be a lot harder.
Fiji Airways is organising a flight Nandi to Tokyo. We have six countries that are shown interest in joining us by coming to Nandi and then flying up to go into pre-games training camps. And then coming back, we would probably have to piggyback on repatriation flights out of Tokyo.
We'll have a team of less than 50 all up. So no, there's no charter flight options for us. So it's very difficult. We've got so many bookings in systems trying to work out how to get the athletes across to Tokyo. There's very limited flights out of Papua New Guinea at the moment. There's not that many out of Australia.
Fans of PNG weightlifter Dikatoa will have been disturbed to read about her apparently being arrested a week or so ago. But Tamsin Wardley says when local media published their stories, the domestic matter had been resolved and Dikat was already in quarantine in Brisbane prior to travelling to Melbourne to be reunited with her longtime coach and mentor, Paul Coffer.
We believe she will be there to represent the country for her fifth Olympics. The matter that's been reported was a personal and family matter, and at this point in time, it's not impacted anything to do with the Olympic team.
And Dika will not be alone when she rejoins the Oceania Weightlifting Institute at its new home. PNG medal hopeful Maria Barra will also be there.
The two of them will be getting back into training with Mr. Coffer, which I'm sure will be a bit of a shock to their systems. They've been training up here the whole time, but literally, in their village and in a makeshift gym.
The hope of every island team will be that they can get their athletes in and out of Tokyo safely and without any risk of their bringing COVID-19 back with them.
Our main push was that you want your athletes to go there vaccinated and to at least ensure that when they come back, they don't bring the virus with them, as best we can judge on departure. But what Tokyo has put in place is essentially what's happening in most of the small island countries, where we're sort of in a modified containment WHO recommended zone.
That's the president of the Oceania National Olympic Committee, Dr. Robin Mitchell, ending that report from Richard Ewart. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the region.